Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Arcademia podcast. Today, we'll be doing our second in a series of how to be successful at university. Just before we start today, I'm going to touch on the fact that the ARB's consultation on education reforms came out this week. We'll be doing a separate podcast further down the line on that to inform everybody about those changes and what it might mean. But in the meantime, what we discuss today will always be applicable to any education that you go through for architecture. So today will be about the part one and the masters. I'm here with my finest gentleman as always, Adam Morgan, and Mr. Jack Johnson.
It's getting better than he is.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
as usual, lads, the floor is going to be yours. I'll start off by asking, we finished with how to be successful in your degree level last time. So the next step after that is your part one, and then you go back after a year out in your part one to do your masters. So tell us about part one life.
Well, for me at the time, it was probably my very first experience of being in an architecture practice. I didn't do work experience or anything. So yeah, it was a bit of a shock, but it's one you get used to after like a few weeks.
So what practice did you start in? Was it a big practice, small practice?
Yeah, so at the time I undertook my part one placement in Nightingale Associates. I think they've been subsequently taken over a few times and they're now owned by Arcadis.
Right.
So they were a really big company at the time, 50 plus staff, which for Liverpool is a big practice. In London, it's probably small to medium size. And yet it was, I enjoyed it. It was a nice year. And I'd have probably stayed there longer if I could, but I had to go back to uni and do the masters.
What about you?
It was a good firm. I remember going to that office. It was a good place to work. It was the observatory, wasn't it?
Yeah, nice environment, nice people, good incentives and stuff.
And they done what we've tried to do in the past, where they broke the desks up lovely, didn't they?
Yeah.
They had, like, you know, sub teams and all that sort of stuff, which I think is quality. I done my part one at BDP.
The big boys,
but yeah. What always been top two or three?
Big design practice. It sounds like.
No, yeah. It's building design partnership. I was just thinking that. I know you knew
founded
that.
Founded by George Grenfell Baines.
There you go. Yeah. And No. So I worked there for my part one, and it was a lovely environment to work in. Again, they split the desks up, not quite by teams though. It was. There was a bit of hierarchy to the way they laid the desks out. I actually personally preferred the way Nightingale's done it, where they had a senior, didn't they? So you had that and the main man. So you had like a senior architect at the end of the table,
yeah,
who then had a team of probably varying experience. Whereas at BDP, it felt like the directors were more towards the kind of the front, which you'd probably rather be tucked away. But in fact, the directors were a bit more towards the front. And then I think actually towards the back were like the technicians and stuff like that. So it didn't feel like it had an order to it, but what it did have was actually the mixture was a very good vibe, very good atmosphere. But if I can be dead honest, my experience was probably harmful for my going back to masters. And that's this first part of this podcast is about what the part one, or how that transitions into the masters, isn't it? And for me, being part of such a big practice, I think that had a proportional effect of how small my role was.
Yeah.
So, great place to work. The projects I worked on were quality. It was 2008, so the world was melting. So I actually took on a couple of projects. Not myself. I literally, again, had a tiny contribution. But there was a couple in Moscow. I think one was an IKEA in Moscow. So that's dead interesting.
Yeah.
But the actual role I had in all of them was minuscule. So I went back to my master's not really any more developed, if I can be dead honest.
So in terms of when you go and you have that first day in office and you meet your superior or whatever, and then they're sitting you down and giving you your first tasks, were you overawed a little bit by it? Was it like new softwares? Was it like, how tough was it, you know, that first few weeks, months?
So it was varying because Nightingale's used AutoCAD and I had experience in AutoCAD. BDP used MicroStation and you used AutoCAD at the time,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah. So and we didn't really even use AutoCAD well, did we? So
no.
So to not even use a software that well and then be told you can't even use that.
So just like the audience that wouldn't know, why is that? So was it just because at LJMU, the university, they only taught you in AutoCAD Is that why you only had knowledge in that, or what's the reason?
No, so sorry to think about. I'd never even heard of MicroStation. That's why.
Right.
Just as simple as that. Right. Never even heard of it.
And they didn't teach you it as well.
No, to be fair, sorry, yeah. No, they didn't teach you it. But I'd never heard of it. So Autodesk obviously do a better job of marketing. Yeah. No, they do. You know, it's as simple as that. Everyone knows what Autodesk is. Everyone knows...
MicroStation, get on us. Bentley Suites, get on us.
I think at the time as well, MicroStation by Bentley, it was cheaper. Yeah. So 6 months into my time at Nightingale, we switched to it.
Oh, so you ended up on it anyway?
Yeah. And the reason was because it was cheaper. The difference I had was everyone was rubbish at it, whereas Adam was going into an environment where they were just expecting you to know it, sort of thing, weren't they? They didn't really say, we know you don't use it, here's how to use it.
That must have been a massive challenge for you then. How did you prepare for that?
BDP had CAD technicians. So they had one or two per office. I was in the Liverpool office, and that office was a satellite office, mainly for Liverpool One. The CAD technicians were like almost like software troubleshooters in a way. But they doubled as that, sorry. But the main role was with kind of limited architectural knowledge, they could then just kind of almost like want for a better phrase, CAD monkey, basically. Yeah. You know, they rolled out a pack of drawings, but the project had to be at a stage where the design decisions were made. So they didn't make design decisions, they just rolled the drawings out. Yeah. But they doubled as troubleshooters. And there was a guy, I think his name was Darren as well, actually. And it just lovely bloke. And he could just see that I'd shat myself, basically, with new software, new practice, massive projects, all that scary enough. And he just come over and he just started looking after me. And I think there was either an educational version or in practice you had a second seat that you could take home. You know, and I then just out of hours, just I had to. I had no option. I had to just learn it because I couldn't even get to step one.
Right.
Without learning it.
So it was all extracurricular after work.
Mainly.
Go home. Yeah, yeah.
To just get it, to even just get up to scratch.
If only you had academia, right?
Could have done with academia.
So we'll put that in.
No, but joking aside, that experience for you was one of the reasons why we did start the platform as well, wasn't it? You know,
absolutely.
Not getting too off track about what we want to speak about today. It was a driver, wasn't it? Because in your part one, day one, you had a hurdle in front of you that you had to get over, and there wasn't much in the way of help apart from maybe one colleague who come and tried to give you a hand.
And then I had a hurdle in front of me because Adam was moaning to me that he didn't know how to use it every lunch time,
and he was like, well, what can I do about it? But on top of that, though, because we've gone a little bit software-y, on top of that, though, you asked about is it intimidating? Is it scary? And all that sort of stuff. And I think it is. I even think when, like, even now, we're a lot more confident than we used to be, even just in this setting, in the office setting and stuff like that. But even if you now go to another consultant's office, and it's a big office, and it's still a bit intimidating, isn't it? You know what I mean? You're quite happy to just get to the meeting room and what have you. So to actually go into a new office, sit down and have to participate in that office, that is scary. And my first day, I went in with a suit and everyone had Converse and jeans on.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I got laced. I got absolutely laced.
Oh, that's
as well.
A briefcase wanker.
Honestly.
No, but that's a killer, because you know when you're that age, you're that impressionable. Your idea of an architect, especially in a big professional practice like BDP, the biggest reputation in the UK, almost global, they're right up there. And so in your mind before you go, you are going to be thinking, oh, I need to put a shirt and shoes on here, I need to be looking the part, and then to go in and see that.
I don't think I'd have ever done a suit, but I was quite fortunate that happened to be in the printers at the final closing stages of me degree, and the guy in the printers, we became quite friendly with him, and there was a guy in there getting printing done, and Pete from the printer said, oh, he works where you're about to work.
Oh, so you got a sense of what the outfit was.
So I started speaking to him, it was Nick. So it was like, oh, jeans.
Yeah, my shoes.
Quite casual, nice shoes. So I thought, do that.
Yeah.
Leave me tuxedo on the hanger.
So did you enjoy that part one aspect then? You know, like, was it everything you expected? Obviously, you finish your degree, still quite green. You come out and you get your first taste of real world practice I'm now, you know, sort of an architect. You know,
and money as well. So that year, you still got no dependencies, and you're getting paid finally to do what you were doing at uni. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would say overall, I enjoyed it.
I did. I loved it.
How different was it to uni though?
Well, yeah, ridiculous.
Night and day. Did you feel like university had prepared you even for your part one level? Because obviously part one in practice, you're not expected to do a lot, are you? You're there to just to give everyone a hand as an assistant. But even for that level of job, did you feel like university had prepared you for that?
Go on,
I felt so, speaking for my own personal experience, because as a byproduct of uni, so everything else aside, I could use AutoCAD. And my very first task was, draw me these layouts, you've got all day. And I'd basically done it in an hour. And I don't think me superior at the time, he was just gauging my ability. So I'd done it quite quick. And then that gave me a bit of confidence then. And so it did prepare me, because I wouldn't have known AutoCAD if it weren't for uni.
Yeah.
What you're touching on there, though, a little bit is, in part one, software proficiency is probably more important than design ability, because in part one, you don't get it to the design a great deal. You get to contribute to projects, but really it is about your proficiency, not just in software, but in timekeeping, you know, all that sort of stuff. So,
well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because one thing that we've spoken about in the past with university is, what we say is, for your degree level, when you're first there, you should probably focus on narrative design, those types of things, to get good marks.
To get top marks at uni, yes.
But then your part one, you should really be more software proficient to be able to do a good job of part one.
Yeah.
Then when you go back for your master's, and we'll obviously get into this more later, you probably do need to be a bit more technical at that point and more software proficient.
It's a bit of a hybrid, because...
But then when you come out of that, you're expected to design. So it's just, no, it feels the wrong way around.
It's a bit of a hybrid, because it steps up in increments, and I think the complexity of the projects at part two grows based on the understanding that you have picked up software ability. So I think it all feeds in.
Okay.
But I haven't had a chance to answer. You know, you said about, did it prepare you for part one? Jack said yes. And my short answer would have been no. What I think university prepares you for is I feel like now it's getting more relevant, if you know what I mean. I think narrative and all this other stuff, work ethic and all that, and design ability and all this other stuff. You touched on it, about to kind of lead you down a path in a certain way. I think it has more relevance later down the line. So I think, personally, I think there should be maybe the last 6 months of your degree should be, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to know for your part one.
Yeah, yeah.
So I personally think it prepares you directly for your part one. What your studies do prepare you for, though, is the kind of being an architect, actually.
Yeah.
The narrative, presenting the reviews, the injustice of, you know, subjectiveness and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It prepares you for all that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's why I was going to say no in short for part one, but yes for the kind of longer game.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Okay.
Yeah.
So by the end of part one, more confidence, I assume, as architects. I know you still said no, not quite, but generally you must have been a touch more confident in being an architect. You're being paid for a year, you nice practice, learned a lot more stuff. Going into your master's, how did you feel? You know, so you're now going back to start that next level of education. Were you totally at ease? Were you like going back in with more confidence, or were you knowing what was coming and a bit apprehensive again of here we go again, back in, going to be a lot of pressure?
I don't know. I'd say I probably was more confident, because I was going in with zero knowledge on anything about it, like at degree level, whereas at like masters and post part one, we've been doing it for some time, haven't we? So I did feel a bit more confident. And as I say, the projects step up proportionately. So if you're expected to do them projects at degree level, you'd struggle, but you've moved on without noticing, really.
Yeah.
It's only when you look back, you notice. So, for example, now I'll look at work from postgraduate, which I thought at the time was amazing, and I go now, I'll probably knock that out in 2 days.
Yeah.
Whereas at the time, it'd take you like months, and I think your ability just progresses in line with where you're at.
you're saying there the projects, I assume you're talking about at uni, the projects step up incrementally.
Yeah, yeah.
And your ability follows that. Give us an example of that. So you first go back, you're back in your master's. How does it step up? How does it get more difficult?
The scale of them. So we were given our first, I'm trying to remember as well. So our first project, you put into groups. Hang on, no, that's 6 years, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that because six years is the one that is quite clear.
Yeah, I'm sure. In my mind. I think fifth year was a bit more workshoppy. So
no, but you remember when? So in fifth year, we had to design a building, and then they done sub modules of you had to do a sustainability thing, yeah. You had to do a detail. So I think what they done was it was a higher level of scrutiny when you went back to your masters. In your degree, I think there's a bit of forgiveness of you don't really know how to detail yet. You don't really understand, say, the embodied energy of a build material, that sort of stuff. You're laughing because I still don't get it now. Yeah. but you know what I mean? So even if you touch on these things in your degree, you kind of get away with it a little bit as long as you're in the ballpark. In the masters, it was very much, no, what you say has got to be correct. You've got to have an understanding of all the other consultants that, you know. So when you're doing a sustainability strategy, you've still got to apply the right sort of things to it. It's less forgiven. And one thing we haven't mentioned is the dissertation is hanging over you. And for me, that was a big, big distraction.
From day one?
Near enough. Day one was, that is fifth year, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all coming back to me now. So yeah. It all merged. And I think most of my memories are of 6 year. I think I might have blanked fifth year out. I think now that I'm recalling it, fifth year was a lot of smaller projects that led on from another. And it was quite intense, actually,
it was
wasn't it?
And fast.
It was like, here's another project. Whereas 6 year was a bit more structured. And you started in like a group on a massive master plan site. Then you split up and then you zoomed in and then kept zooming in on your level of detail till you ended up at a building. And that's probably more akin to what people do now, isn't it? Was fifth year a bit of an anomaly year? Was it a bit of a trial year? Or did they always do that?
Well, I don't know. Well, remember when they told us the fifth year didn't matter as well? And it did. So they told us, fifth year is about getting back into it. It's all about your sixth year work. And ultimately, we felt, or I did anyway, I felt like I got a little bit punished for it because there was moments in fifth year where we switched off a little bit, didn't we? And we didn't think it counted. And this is a life lesson, this. Whether it directly counts or not, what we went on to discover, and I won't tell you how we discovered it because it wouldn't be appropriate, but but what we went on to discover was it didn't directly count, but they were still watching you.
Yeah. Okay.
If you know what it still affected. And by the way, I don't think this is unfair. I think this is fair. It still affected maybe, people's impression of you or maybe if you were borderline, maybe it affected what side of the borderline things like that. And I actually think that is fair because you should always be switched on, really, shouldn't you? You know what I mean? You should have an attitude of everything I'm doing every single day is contributing to my career. And that's something that sometimes I've been critical of. People that I've worked with in the past where sometimes I say, I can't believe that they're not giving it everything, because whether they're not happy in that certain practice or whatever, what they're working on will contribute to their own personal portfolio one day. Yeah. And sometimes I say, don't I, it really frustrates me that if they're not willing to work hard in that situation, they should still get themselves motivated by selfishly. That will contribute to the career. And there was times in fifth year where there was just points when I was like, it was a dead early lecture, I'd just miss it because I was told it didn't contribute.
Yeah.
But really, I should have been like, no, that lecture's important. I should focus on it. So,
well, I was going to ask you about anything you'd do differently. So there's one straight away. Yeah, yeah. It's massively fully focused at all times.
And spread the dissertation out as well. I just rushed my dissertation like last minute where I said, well, it hanging over you. It needn't hang over you if you just manage it properly. You just do, 400-500 words, maybe every few days, because it was lengthy, wasn't it? Was it like 10,000 words? Yeah.
Do it on something you're passionate about as well. We based ours on something we had a lot of books on.
You know, we went mega technical because we had like loads of double skin facade books and stuff.
So that shaped why we chose that type of dissertation, whereas it was boring and I'd probably do it on something more interesting.
Yeah. And you had to present section of your dissertation to a panel and we were boring them to death, weren't we?
Yeah.
So you're touching on dissertation already there. So that process, 50 years seems like for both of you, it sort of came and went. You know, like you almost didn't seem to be that important. It was just a stepping stone to get into that big, important 60 year.
That's how we approached it.
Yeah.
It was about getting yourself back in the game, getting yourself geared up towards what was called the comprehensive design project. And that was second semester of 60 year as well. You know what I mean? So when you're in 50, you think, well, that's ages away. Yeah. So go on, sorry.
So just where I'm leading with that is, again, just in my mind and what like people who aren't at that level yet might be wondering is that progression again. You know, so, you know, the last podcast we were talking about succeeding at degree level, you've done that, you've done your part one, you come back. What's different? So you know, you go through that fifth year. How are you improving? What skills are you getting better at to enable you to succeed at that next point?
Well, I'd say personally, the skills I'd picked up on my year out were my SketchUp ability had drastically improved, which allowed me to test what I was doing in uni better. Whereas at part one, I'd be like, I can't model that, so I'll do it like this. And it sort of shaped the way I was doing things, whereas I could pretty much model anything and draw anything by the time I was back. So it's reflected in your designs.
So you're again, going back to software capabilities then. So you mentioned SketchUp there, which is a program that we still use, still really relevant. You'd learned new skills in that while you were on your
part one. Well, I'd learned it. I thought I knew it in my degree and I didn't.
You didn't.
So you learned how to use it properly, didn't you?
Yeah, you improved practice. Your knowledge on it.
Yeah.
And then, so what could you do differently?
I could use it. No,
group.
Yeah, so basically I didn't use to group anything. And in principle, you group everything in SketchUp. You make anything that replicates a component. So when you edit one, it edits them all. The paste in place tool is key, isn't it? So you start off doing like group work. So if you've got the ability to, like Adam had modelled one bit of the site, I'd model another, we'd have a central model where we'd paste what we'd done in at the end of the day. And it's working within the structure of a team and organisation and efficiency and stuff, which allows you to work on a bigger scale, which the projects evolve into in postgraduate.
Yeah.
Whereas you're just sort of muddling your way through a degree, aren't you? And you're like, I can't do this, but I can do this. And
You sort of, you approach your work at what's easiest for you based on your knowledge. Yeah.
You'd pick a section that doesn't cut through a window because it's easier to draw.
Well, say easier. I think sometimes that relates to time, doesn't it? Because everything has a deadline. So sometimes easier just means quicker. And the one thing about becoming more proficient in software, components and things like that being a key part of that, once you figure that out, it saves you so much time.
Yeah.
So you know confidently in your head when you're approaching your work, well, I can have a few design revisions here because if I get the first one wrong, I'm quick enough in that software now to go again. Whereas I suppose if you haven't got that ability, you're behind straight away, aren't you?
So just to add to that's what really you should be going into your master's with is giving yourself more design time. That's the, if you think of it, you know, if you think of like the duration of a project as like a little, like a scale. When we were in our degree, we had to leave loads of room, didn't we, to produce. So it really cut down our design time. And that's not just designing in conceptual form, that's designing it so it's resolved enough as well, you know, so it works, never mind just the conceptual stuff. And what was nice was when we both learned in practice, we learned it in a structured way. And what I mean by that is the structure that we had available to us where senior members of staff over the shoulder saying, this is how you work on a large scale job with a team. Mm. And that gives you the ability to make changes quicker. Say, you know, the production's quicker, all this sort of stuff. And what it does is on that scale then, it really minimises your production time. So then you've got all that freedom then. Mm. So just take a breath, design, come up with options, loads of different concepts. You know, maybe even have a little dabble with some physical models and stuff. You know what I mean? Just little conceptual work and models, because you've got that level of confidence to go, you know what? I know I can turn that round in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Big difference, big advantage. And that's the thing about, You know, we joked earlier about, you know, we wish we had academia. That's genuinely the reason why we believe in it so much, because we would have used it
yeah.
at that point in time. Probably, I'd have definitely used it on my year out, but even the summers between, particularly, you know, I'd have, you know, as in like the sort of maybe the summer between second and third year, the summer. Maybe between fifth and sixth, or you know, sometimes you might give yourself a month after you finished your degree before you work in practice. Just get yourself, you know, yeah, get yourself slicker in some of these things, and if you can kind of guarantee that you've got that nailed, you can just focus on the bigger stuff, the more yeah. complicated stuff.
Well, you're less stressed, I suppose, then, aren't you? Because
yeah.
you're more confident in your abilities. You know, you've got time, so you can just focus on. Those important
the
things.
Feeling of having time is probably yeah. the most yeah. relaxing thing. Yeah,
you start to ascertain how long stuff takes to do as well yeah. because a degree, you're like, I don't know how long this is going to take, and then you end up all night, like,
yeah,
doing stuff. Whereas by the time you get to postgraduate, you're like, I know that'll take me half a day, so I'll do that in that half a day, and that translates to now in practice. You sometimes have a deadline, and you'll be like, yeah, but I won't start it till midweek because I know it'll only take me a day.
Yeah.
But then going back to the original question of, you know, how does it change? You know, how does the masters differ and all that sort of stuff? There's an awareness from the tutors, isn't there? That you should be at this level now as well. So the deadlines are tighter. You know, I suppose it's thicker and faster. There was one kind of headline project that you could design conceptually, and then they split these submodules off it, and they were every couple of weeks, weren't they? It was, you have to come in with your sustainability, your structural, you have to come in with your facade design, didn't you? It was like every couple of weeks you had to get up and present, and
yeah.
you know what I mean? And like I say, you had the dissertation hanging over you.
Didn't enjoy fifth year.
No. Well, I think that's why we blanked it out. And we have architectural theory as well, where you got absolutely robbed? That was fifth year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so you
What's
had
that.
So architectural theory, right?
Oh,
is,
yeah.
Yeah. That was fifth year, wasn't it?
The building in Japan, the round one, was it by Bernard Tschumi?
No, it was a book. No, yours was the Bernard Tschumi book. It wasn't based on a building. I'm sure it was just a book. So when I think of architectural theory now, I just think of like the theory of either narrative or design.
Yeah, no, but it was a theory and one of the buildings, wasn't it?
Well, either way, neither of us got it. We thought we did, but it was... It was another, so it was like narrative plus. Like
right.
It was now the good, the benefit of it, right? I'll be honest, and it sounds a bit thingy, but I've never had to apply this level of theory to anything I've done in practice. Whereas the traditional way of explaining narrative, where the building should have a meaning behind it, we have used that narrative. In practice, but this one was just another layer. It was a very academic, like an architectural philosopher almost. Mm. And what they did was, there was a reading list, and you had to read this book, and then you had to then present your interpretation of that book. And the book was around a form of architectural theory. There was nothing on design. There was nothing on like the proportion, the size of a window, or nothing. Yeah. It was such a high level of thinking. And I thought Jack presented very well. He'd done well. He'd done a good job of it. And the tutor, who let's keep it unnamed, the tutor said, you know, well presented, do you feel you understood it? And quite confidently, Jack went, yeah, I understand that. And he went, you don't.
No, I can remember now. Yeah. He said, I don't feel you did because I don't even understand this architect. So I was like, well,
no one
chance of how can we comment then?
We're at
an impasse. If you don't understand it, how can you say I don't?
Well, how can he officiate over who understands?
Imagine
it
a referee in 40 didn't know the rules.
Yeah, so
he definitely understood it more than me, and I think he was just being a bit profound with his
example.
Because
then he still gave me a decent mark,
which didn't make
sense.
Yeah,
because he told me I was shite.
Yeah. I didn't get a good mark.
I think he was just like mind fucking me.
I suppose he's the point was thinking, trying to put myself in someone's shoes, like that is, you can never fully understand it. Maybe it's something that you're always supposed to just be thinking about and improving upon or whatever, you know, and questioning things and whatever, rather than having a full grasp on it. Because who can say they fully understand architecture ever in all its components, you know? So maybe that was the point he was trying to make.
Yeah. But so that felt like, I could be wrong, but it felt, you know, just thinking back, that felt like that was another thing hanging over us. So you had a dissertation, which was a very long period, say 3 or 4 months period, where they said to you, that deadline's 4 months. Now you're used to 2 weeks, so you're going, 4 months, that's loads of time. Yeah. That's what I done, right? Yeah. And I'm sure architectural theory was another one, you know, like another quite lengthy one where just you give you a decent amount of time to get your reading done and all that sort of stuff and then present it. So you had these kind of, like, if it was like a Gantt chart, you'd have like that over there, that hanging over you, and then underneath was, you know what I mean? So it was like, whoa, so there was loads going on. But going back to, like, does it prepare you for X? What that does prepare you for is the proper real world, because you cannot work on just one thing. You've got loads going on, loads of distractions.
Especially after masters, when you go back, when more responsibilities put
on
you.
So the masters, in my experience, does get you really trained for that.
Yeah. Well, what would be nice to hear, actually, is what you remember of it. So, like, maybe more sixth year and stuff. What was masters like for you?
Yeah, let's move into sixth.
So, like, what was it like? So, like, you know, you very quickly sort of explained it before, what you said. We started off with something big, and then, but go into the detail. What was that like? What was the projects that you guys were given? First, it was a team, then it gets smaller, and then you end up your own building and stuff. What were the specifics of that?
Do you want me to go?
Go on, you go. You're recollecting uni a lot better than me.
Yeah.
Because I've been up early with the kids.
So there was the start of 6 year. Again, as I remember it, I'm probably filling these into blanks. I might even be throwing a bit of 5th year, but as I remember it, was there was a local site and an international site. And the year almost got split in half as a result of that. And I think there was an allocation. I think generally speaking, what they were saying was, not everyone can just pick the local site. You have to do international, local. I forget the place of the international one, but I'll be honest with you, it looked really difficult. The international one, it looked very conservation-led. It was like a castle or something. And it was like a master plan around. It looked really tough. And I genuinely felt that the travelling needed, because you had to travel out there.
You had to go to see
something.
Is it like Belgium or
something like that? I felt like that would have got in the way. You know, so I was desperate to have the local one, because the local one was in Liverpool. It didn't necessarily need to be in Liverpool. The local one could have just been maybe the north of England, for example. But it was in Liverpool. So you had an option of the site very, very first and foremost. That split the year in half. And I'm sure they had slightly different briefs because of the different, you know, context to it. We went local and... just thinking of League of Gentlemen.
Yeah.
So we went local, and then
local.
Yeah. and then we got the option to pick groups, didn't we? Sorry, I was just thinking then. So we then got the option to pick our groups. This was my idea, right? I said, right, we knew who the two best were in the year. I said,
oh, so you actually got to physically pick
the group.
So you could, so like there was super groups or whatever.
I actually think we lobbied for this, didn't we? Our year was a very strong year for characters.
Because we knew we were good at software and lacking in the narrative.
So again, I'm going to be careful with thinking. But you know what? The two people that we worked with were absolutely... I haven't got a bad word about them to say about them. They're absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I just felt a little hard done to towards the end, which we'll get to in a minute. So I'm sure that originally you were going to be assigned group by, say, alphabetical order, just for example. And a few looked at it and gone and just sort of said, well, I'll end up with such and such that either I don't get along with, or maybe even I don't race, to be honest. You know, there was a little bit of that.
It was quite brutal.
It was brutal.
The popular kids and you can't sit with us vibe.
So there were a few people in the year who were sort of just left in the corner.
Like resitting for like the ninth time. And
obviously you didn't want to go near them because they'd always failed.
Ah, you know what we haven't mentioned? Actually, the difference between masters and degree as well is masters has the potential to have sort of recycled students from other years. You know what I mean? It mightn't be failed. It might just be some might have took a year out. Yeah, an extra year out. So they'll have been a year above you, but they're now in the same year as you. But probably a bit more advanced, aren't they? Because they've had another year in practice and stuff. So it was a very different dynamic. But the group work was, originally you were assigned it, And we all got together as a year group. It was brilliant. It was impressive. The whole year group got together and we just said, no, we're not having this. We want the ability to pick our own groups. And they just said, well, go on. I'm pretty sure the wins. It's not that big of a deal. Go on. Yeah. We made a stink of it. And they were like, yeah, yeah, whatever. So they were dead cool about it. So then me and Jack were like, well, we know our strengths. And at that point, we did do well in our degree. So, you know, we were talking about first and second year, we were bang average, but we moved up the ranks, we felt, in third year. So we felt we had a lot to bring. We knew the top two were, so we went straight over to them and said, look, we almost pitched them. And
we were like Man City, weren't we?
Yeah, trying to sweep up. And we went over to them and said, we think with your skill sets of narrative and even like presentation and all that sort of stuff, we think we can bring a lot to it in terms of production, efficiency, time management, all that sort of, you know, software knowledge, and bring it all together. And they were like, absolutely. They, to our surprise, actually quite rated us. Mm. So we were like, this is perfect. So we went into it, and what we did was we just assigned each other roles, didn't we? And it was very clear. We all rated one another in certain specialisms almost.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, well, such and such is going to do the main headline narrative, and then such and such is going to do the, maybe, you know how we're going to lay maybe the presentations out. What, you know, I say one of the guys we went to had a lovely eye for, you know, graphics and presentation, lots of stuff. And then we were then kind of assigned, okay, well, then we'll produce X, Y, and Z. And we done a bloody good job of that first project, didn't we? We got top marks of the year. Absolutely. Smashed it out of the park, didn't we?
Top tip, go and get the best in the year. Make sure you get them on sack.
But it went downhill from there.
Go and team up with the good ones.
Yeah. but we weren't shite, were we? So what happened was we did form a really, really strong group. And the project was, again, narrative. Start with a narrative. And it was about the decrease of... I think it was the decrease of natural food production, wasn't it? Something like that. It was to do with solving...
And like pollination and
certain
stuff,
issues,
it?
Yeah. So it was solving certain issues in the food chain that were kind of natural causes to do with like climate change and things like that. So we said, well, that's our narrative. We want this master plan to be like a kind of like a centre of excellence of how to grow food in all these different ways.
Right.
And what we did was we come up with, let's just say 10 different ways. So we've done loads of research.
I bet you we can dig this out and put it on the screen, can't we?
Go on, I'll do my best to just, we'll do a little ding. And we come up with, I'll just say 10 for argument's sake, we come up with 10 different ways to tackle these issues. And then what we did, right, was we took a vantage point from over the water. So the site was in Everton Park in Liverpool. And we knew that had a very good vantage point of its own. We then went across the Mersey in the Wirral, and we set 10 key views from the Wirral. Those 10 views struck a line on the site.
No, we reversed it.
Go on.
It was a panoramic view looking from the site, wasn't it?
So you got it the wrong way round. Fair enough.
So we set a panoramic grid and a contour grid.
But it was, yeah, but the panoramic grid was the number of different ways of cultivating the food.
So there was like 10 strips, wasn't
there? 10 strips, that's it, yeah.
And we fanned out, and then we used the contour map to give the grid the other way. And that, in effect, similar principle to like Barcelona, where you have such a rigid grid, it gave us a grid for our master plan.
But what was cool was we had a rigid grid that way. I know the grid was rigid in that we used it literally. But the fanning out, I got the wrong way around. It was looking from the site to the Wirral then. And then we fanned it out. We created it. And it was to do with the skyline and stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then we picked the 10. We created these 10 divides with these 10 viewpoints. That created the 10 ways of forming food creation. And it went from natural to a man-made.
Artificial.
Right. So, and it got more artificial. So it went from like old school farming techniques to full robotics. Right. It was, you know, a really nice way of, and we haven't drew a single line yet. This is all narrative to do with the divisions and all sorts of stuff. But I suppose we started drawing a line with the fan and thing. And then Jack mentioned the contours. So a grid obviously needs two axes, doesn't it? And the other axis was a more organic shape. So the fanning of the view was rigid. And then the other one was organic. And you know, the shape that made on the site was just incredible, wasn't it? Mm. So it was it almost kind of designed itself, didn't it?
Yeah.
From that point.
So almost like the success of that project come from that beginning. It was quite easy from there, because once you're into the drawing bit, that's what you're good at.
Because you didn't need to bullshit then, because it all just got pinned back to that.
Yeah.
Coupled with the girl in the group who was excellent at speaking. So whereas we'd know what we wanted to say and sometimes miss the point, she never missed a beat, did she, in the presentation?
Amazing presenter.
So I think we covered a lot of bases with it.
Yeah.
So you get through that first bit. I just learned it. So you, just on a personal level, did you just took anything from the other two that
massively.
You partnered up with?
Yeah.
And do you feel like that helped you going forward as well into the when you come down into your own work? Then you thought, hang on a minute. That they actually have put something in me that I need to use.
Well, I try. So the guy in the group, I pretty much just tried to adopt his drawing style. It was amazing.
Basically, what happened was we ended up with a really good project, master plan project. And if you deviated from the way that was stylized going forward, it would have looked odd because all the work got pinned up next to each other at the end. So you sort of had to stick to that palette.
So the individual project at the end, we were still had to present as a four, didn't we? Not at the same time. What I mean is the actual space you had, say, you know, literally four walls. Well, every group was a team of four. Right. So the allocation of your final project presentation was always in lots of four. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
So we were pinned up next to the two best in the year.
So that's when it went downhill. Because then
we hadn't thought that far ahead.
No, so we had. No,
so you've got like, so when you walked into your display, you know, your presentation for, you've got the group project.
Yeah,
you know, the group project
with a lovely laser cut model. By the way,
So then your work's there, Jack's work's there, and then the other side are the two best in the year. So then yours comparatively then looks that little bit worse.
So that's
the, whereas that's if you put thing. Us in the next booth, we probably
you've got top marks. Probably, well, yeah.
Potentially, yeah.
No, so that's probably unfair. But
no, but I forget. But what isn't unfair is that we put ourselves with the two best in the year, so we couldn't compete with them too. You know, in terms of like for like, so we benefited from sharing the skill set and all that, and we benefited from. And to be fair, they benefited from some of our input as well. But we benefited from the great presentation. In terms of, you know, verbally, the great presentation on the board and all that sort of stuff. But before we get to the individual project, the master plan went from, say, a 1 to 2,500 scale to, it went to a 1 to 500 scale, didn't it? And I failed, not failed, but I'd done a really poor job of that. I really struggled.
On an individual basis, though, this is the 1 to 500. Yeah.
So what it's trying to do is, it's trying to set the scene for your final project. So the master plan obviously gives you a chance to pick. So in our instance, we just wanted to pick one of the 10 strips, didn't we? So there's four of us. And we had an opportunity. Do you want to go mega natural? Or do you want to go mega, you know, artificial with it? And obviously you can almost picture different aesthetics, can't you, to go along
and
with
you
that?
You couldn't all pick the same site as well. Could you?
No. Yeah.
And everyone wanted, I think there was one good site, wasn't there?
I think the first one was the nicest one because it had all the shapes. So, what I really struggled with, you've done a lot better job than I did. You had to then add a layer of detail to a master plan, which I just couldn't wrap my head around. Honestly, I just couldn't wrap my head around it. It was, is there much of a difference really to go from 1 to 2,500 to 1 to 500? Is there much of a difference in terms of the positioning of blocks and the creation of like little, you know, little piazzas and all that sort of stuff?
The answer is yes.
I was just going to say, you know, what was the level of detail then? So at 1 to 2,500, it's literally square or shapes just on a page.
Yeah, very simple shapes.
And you're just delineating important parts. Then you go in. What is the difference?
Well, go on, so I didn't get it, so go on.
So then you have to like go in and like break the blocks up further and like... I had the far end block, I think.
You were more artificial.
I was very artificial.
I think you were the most artificial out of
and,
the four.
Yeah, and I zoomed in and when you looked at it at Masterplan, it was all right. And then when you zoomed in, it was like... I needed a piazza, a termination point in the design, and I didn't have one. And you just start interrogating it in a level of detail. Like we put a canal in, haven't we? That followed one of the contours. And like, how do you design a canal edge? It's all stuff like that. And
the one I got really wrong was proximity of buildings. So obviously now, we know all too well about privacy distances. That's one aspect, but there's fire. You know, if two buildings are too close together, fire can bridge and all this other stuff. Obviously, other than them being joined, that's another matter. So what I really just got wrong was, I mean, maybe even I got a bit lazy with it, but it was more lack of understanding. Was when I zoomed in, I just thought, well, this master plan's amazing. So I just zoom in just different scale bars.
Just crop it, put it back in.
Happy days, you know what I mean? But as Jack said there, I didn't think of how I can finesse the buildings. So the buildings needed more looking into. So a big, massive square isn't an efficient way of getting daylight in, for example. So a good way of getting daylight in is almost like a donut shape in a square. So you cut the middle out. You're thinking about how daylight's getting into the buildings. Yeah. You're thinking about routes to the building. He's talking about edges of squares, canals.
And then it's testing their routes. And so like placing yourself on the route and what you can see at the end of it. So you do it and then there'd be nothing at the end to terminate your route. So then you'd have to put a building in. Then it's not tall enough. So you make it higher to give you like...
And that's urban design, or the massing of it all. And
I quite enjoy it, like with hindsight.
Yeah, well, now I get it a bit more. So I do a better job of it now.
What was the, you know, when you're first cracking it open and I'm talking to you here, that's because you were saying you didn't get it as much. You know, when you look at that initial master plan and they've told you it's amazing and you got top marks, is there something in your mind going, I can't really mess with this? Because if I start deleting buildings out of this to make space for other things, that it won't be as good.
Does it hurt the... Yeah, you know, that's a great point.
So it's almost like you're looking at it and sometimes you feel like, you might look at it and say, yeah, I want to get rid of those two. But then in your mind you're going, but hang on, it's in the master plan. You like that, so I don't want to take them out.
You know, you've just sparked a little memory there. I almost lost a bit of confidence in it because I was as part of such a strong team and we all contributed to it. And to be honest with you, I'll make no bones about it. I felt like it was a good political decision to partner with two of the best in the year. I almost lost a bit of confidence after that because I didn't have them with me anymore. You're absolutely spot on there with, when I looked at it, I did think, well, is that right now? I don't know.
You know, I don't want to mess with it.
I don't
want to
mess with it. But it was more of a lack of confidence, though. Do you know what I mean? It was. I'd say, but where Jack got it, he had a bit more confidence, I think, anyway. A bit more confidence in making some of these alterations, the incisions, all that sort of stuff. I pretty much did just sort of go, as good as it was, I don't want to tinker with it too much. Mm. But when Jack's talking about like the views and stuff, looking back, it's actually quite a nice process to just, we had it all modelled in SketchUp, right? And you know, to test the little views, all you need to do is just put your little, you know, there's like a little man icon, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you just click on the model, it pulls the camera down to a perspective view. You could just pick 10 of them, print them off, trace over them, and then just start to sketch on top of that. What should it look like, you know, before you start re-editing the model? Mm. You could actually do these lovely little view tests, could your little sketches, just these little thingies. And you know what? If you put that into a presentation to say, I've tested all these routes, and here's the sketching, here's what it looked like once, here's the solution, and all that sort of stuff. That's actually a lovely process.
It's the journey as opposed to the destination, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And that's what the testing you're on at that stage, whereas we were like, we've done it, and they were like, how'd you get there? And they'd actively encourage you to have really thick sketchbooks and stuff, and we didn't really take advantage of it, did we?
Nowhere near. You know the use of I still do it now, to be honest. You treat some things as a bit of a box ticking exercise. Yeah. I thought that's what the sketchbook was, but it wasn't really. It was about exploring these ideas. And in the idea then, what should have come from it? I wish I could do it again now, actually thinking about it. What should have come from it is, and I'd say Jack done a really good job of this, and so did the other two. What then should have come from that was the end of that. That's the end of the first semester.
Yeah.
The first semester of 6 year was split into the big master plan and the mini master plan. And then the entire second semester then was dedicated to your single project. By Christmas, you should then have had your mini master plan and you should have picked one building then. So you've picked you've done your big master plan. You've then picked your zone. So our zones were easy to define, one of the 10 strips.
Yeah.
You've then gone into a layer of detail where you might have even only designed either one of the strips or maybe even 50% of the strips. And in that might have been 10 buildings. And the point of it was to then go, I'm going to pick that one building. But if you've done a good job of the mini master plan, then you give yourself, I think, an advantage then to design the building because it's surrounding.
Because if you haven't, you then revisit and stuff you should have done.
Yeah.
And that's where, and I lost time then. So the first couple of months of second semester, I was still fanning around with me.
So did you pick like for your drill down one for your personal project the last second semester, was your building like on the piazza that you'd already, like a nice bit of the mini master plan in your life?
No, I don't think it was. It was nestled into, it was quite a steep topography. It was nestled into it, and it was it was further up, but there was a reason why I chose it. I'd have to revisit it to remember because I haven't looked at it for about 10 years.
But nonetheless, you set the scene better, didn't you? You know, again, just between me and him, It was yeah, you know, you set the scene better. So then going into second semester, just, you know, bit more prepared, and all that sort of stuff, but I was still tinkering.
So coming towards the end of like the master's journey now then. So second semester, you're on your own. You drill down into your building now that you're gonna finish on, and you've got the dissertation looming over you. Just take us through that.
Dissertation's
done in fifth year, sorry. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. So the dissertation's
Don't
done.
Throw a dissertation at me again.
In sixth sorry. Year. No, sorry. No. So it was completed in fifth year.
Yeah.
And that was a big relief, actually. You know, you said about, you know, almost like fifth year was a bit, you know, it sort of passed us by a bit. There's a bit of truth in that. In it come thick and fast. There was a lot to juggle, a lot to mess with. I do feel like, maybe that's why we've got better memories of it. I do feel like I enjoyed sixth year more because it was a bit more structured than it was, and one thing led to the next, and it felt like I had a bit more breathing space than there.
Yeah.
So the reason I mentioned that then, because we didn't really drill down into the dissertation, you very likely touched on double skin facades earlier. That must be a really tough and hard part of uni. What was the dissertation like? Because we haven't really gone into that in any detail.
I mean, I hate to.
No, so yes, but why? Like, why was it so hard? Was it just because it was? Is it all written work at that point? Is it?
No, not necessarily. It's called a specialist study, actually, isn't it? It's not called a dissertation. It's not just written work. It's all about the research, and you know, people with appendices and drawings and stuff in it, and. I don't think we got it as much, did we? We just seen it as a.
So what
we've
got
to write a
us?
Dissertation
again. Another box to tick. It felt like, yeah. And then as a result, we didn't give it.
We didn't get the best out of it.
What it was worth.
So, but what did you do?
So mine was on double skin facades, and the reason I chose it was because I had a load of books on double skin.
But it didn't.
Facades.
It didn't stop at double skin facades. Did it? It was an application, wasn't there?
Well, I was analysing case studies of why you'd use them and stuff and. I think I concluded that you use them to try and ventilate a building naturally or as an acoustic barrier, you know, if you're on a really main road or a railway. And ultimately, I found that a lot of them were failing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's so much that can go wrong with them.
So yours was like, what's the point of them?
Yeah, effectively, yeah. And it went through the journey of like trying to dig out the first ones that we used and then how it evolved over time. And
it was quite research-led.
Yeah, research.
Right, so, and that's time.
It was
extensive, isn't it?
Was
it?
Very,
it's loads of case studies.
Very boring, yeah. I wouldn't pick it again with hindsight. What I'd say is always pick something you're passionate about, whereas I know some done it on Liverpool and areas of Liverpool. I'd have done that.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I do like looking at Liverpool, you know, historically and how it's changed over time. And
yeah.
I'd have enjoyed that and got a lot out of it, whereas I was missing the point. I was just trying to tick the box.
So that's absolutely. A great tip, isn't it, for anyone who's going to be coming up to that year where they've got to do the dissertation. That's really helpful advice, isn't it?
What's the point?
Choose something that you're really interested in so that research and that a lot of time that you're going to be spending that year is spent on something that you actually enjoy rather than...
It becomes enjoyable rather than an obstacle you've got to get over.
Very good point. Mine was similar where it wasn't double skinned, but mine was about... Can you retrofit? And to be fair, this is kind of coming up at the minute, but not in the way I was proposing. Where can you retrofit buildings with a second skin that had like photovoltaics in the facade to generate energy?
Very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, it sounds about right, but again, I just didn't back it up enough. You know, with the science and all that sort of stuff. I used a couple of case study buildings where the buildings were very inefficient, they were very drafty buildings, all sort of stuff. Whereas if you quite literally skinned it in something else and that skin could generate electricity, you know, it went some way to sort of go, you know, that could be a solve, but there's still a lot of hidden nasties in the creation of these products, the embodied energy of the creation of these products and the actual practicalities of you know, putting an entire new skin on a build and all that sort of stuff was quite thingy. And I just didn't fully grasp it. I wasn't fully motivated for it. And I also felt the tuition I got on it was a little bit misleading, to be honest, in terms of like, I'd rather, they just said to me, you're miles off it. Do you know what I mean? It was weird as the tuition I was getting on it, the commentary. So you get given a dedicated dissertation specialist study. You get given a dedicated tutor to that, you know, for the dissertation. Yeah. And they divvy out the tutors in line with, you know, some tutors are more philosophical, more and more technical, all that sort of stuff. And mine just kind of gave me the impression it could be my fault. I could have interpreted it wrong. It could have been my own ego getting in the way, thinking I was doing very well. It just felt like I wasn't getting given the critique of this is miles off. It was just, yeah, you know, just change this. It was, you know, grammatical errors and things. Mm. And I actually got quite a poor mark in the end. And I still to this day don't know why.
You were quite shocked about it, yeah.
Yeah, because I thought I'd done a decent job of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got quite a poor mark. And I still actually didn't fully understand why. So I think going back to Jack's point of like pick something you're passionate about, I think we've mentioned a few times about didn't get it and didn't understand it, didn't follow it. I think if you pick a topic that you're passionate about, I think inherently you'll get it, won't you? You'll just inherently know what you want to achieve from it.
Yeah. Oh, good.
But yeah, it was tough, really difficult to juggle it, wasn't it? Juggle it with a lot of design work, a lot of module based work to juggle that. Yeah, yeah. But as I say, it's what happens.
You get through it, don't you?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. And it prepares you for the real world.
Yeah. So then on to that final piece then of the second semester of sixth year. How did it go for both years?
It's all right, wasn't it, really, in the end?
We didn't light the world up, but we...
We done all right.
The buildings?
What was yours again? Baths, wasn't it?
Mine was merging two contradictory use classes. So I was at the artificial end of the master plan. So mine was producing soya. Something to do with soya, wasn't it? Soya meat or... can't remember.
I thought it was like Roman baths or something.
Yeah, yeah. So no. So it was the industrial
way off here.
It was the industrial process of soya beans and that making it was grown on in the growing strips on the site. They were shipped into my facility. They were processed and food like soya meat and stuff was made from it.
So kind of like artificial.
The byproduct of that was the heat from the industrial process, and it informed the. A Roman bat, so it was like a Roman
bat. Heat released from that.
Yeah, heat recovery system, yeah.
Recovered into a bat. And so it was quite a surreal environment that you'd be in a bat in like a factory.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was the process.
Some of the visuals that I had done for that were pretty
good. Yeah, well, again, you know, we spoke about this and I think it was the first podcast maybe where we said having a good group of friends at university is one of the key things, isn't it? Because helping each other out, like you helping Jack with visuals and whatever.
So I done that to just bring that up jokingly. Yeah. I think you helped me with my floor plans, didn't you? I remember one of the tutors saying that the floor plan is the most important drawing in your presentation. Make sure you get it spot on. And I remember looking at it going, it looks all right. And he kept saying to me, it's not, you know, not Jack, the tutor kept saying, no, it needs improving. I think, so Jack helped me with a lot of my drawings and physical models. And I always had an eye for visuals. And I think I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think you know if you work in a team, I'm sure I went to the two others. We were in a group work and just said to them, "Can you just give me a little lift on my narrative? What you think? You know, a bit of critique." And again, that's what happens in an office, isn't it?
I was just going to say that's exactly how it is when you come out of uni, isn't it? And you start work. Is there are people in every office who are strong in areas and weak in others? So you keep them in that role, don't you? And say, "Well, that's where you're strong. You do that for me."
Yeah.
Whether it's presentations, like you mentioned before. Or the girl in your group who was superb at presentations. Well, if that's in an office, they're the ones who are inherently going out to meet the clients and pitch for jobs, and that's how it works.
And what was I going to say? Oh, that was it. The misconception that you're in competition. So you're encouraging people later to sort of say, work as a team. Well, you'll be a lot better off because, and I think, maybe I'm just being a little bit self-critical, but I feel like I probably am worse than Jack in this regard, where that sort of me against the world mentality. And there was an air of competition in uni, wasn't there? You know, other people were a little bit, you know, can't see me answers. There was a bit of that.
Yeah.
And there was a few times when tutors did say, yous aren't competing against each other. Yous might think you are, but you're not. There's enough work out there for all of yous. Mm. So the tutors were even telling us this. Now,
yeah,
looking
there
back,
was a guy, wasn't there? So we were all working on similar projects around the city. And there was a guy who'd modelled a certain building and he wouldn't share it with everyone else. And it's like, come on.
Yeah. Some of them worked at practices who had like little city models and things and they wouldn't share it and all that sort of stuff. And there is, we know now, there is no copyright issue if it's used for educational purposes.
Yeah.
So they went, oh no, I can't share it. You can. Yeah. If, as long as it stays within, you know, the educational sort of realm. And so a little bit of advice is to try and form a little bit of a team.
Yeah.
Try and form an allegiance, even if it's a temporary one where you are just thinking of it as a skill-based thing. You know, cozy up to people who you think have got the right sort of skill sets and work as a team. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And again, it takes the pressure off, takes the stress away, probably cuts out the, or at least minimises the long nights, because you know then if you've got a visual guy who's dealing with the visuals, as long as you can give a bit back, so you could be the physical model guy who's helping everyone with all the physical models.
Yeah.
That'll be absolutely amazing. And, you know, you're all in it together. And then there's enough work out there. There's thousands of jobs that once you come out of uni, you'll all be better off, won't you?
Did you do a module during this where you worked with other consultants?
Oh, the other there's degrees? Another one we blanked out.
Fifth year, I swear of that.
No, yeah. No, like for obviously, very, very, very for people watching and tuning in, obviously, if they've got this to come, when you'd have to do that, it's not just a group within your...
Yeah, because even though we're talking from the experience of our university that we went to, I still like the way you're saying that, because I still think what we're talking about, dissertations, individual projects, group projects, they all apply, don't they?
Yeah, they apply to
everyone. And this one, I'd be surprised, again, if it doesn't apply to everyone, where they partnered what was called the art and design building, so that was us, they partnered the art and design building with the built environment building. And the built environment building was quantity surveyors, project managers, town planners, I think there's a, you know, a few others, all complementary to architecture. And what was bizarre about it was, I'm sure it was fifth year architects, but it was third year in all the others. And why that's so profound is, or important is, their degree was on the line, ours wasn't.
Yeah.
So it was a strange dynamic. They were all panicking.
Yeah.
They were a lot more stressed than us, weren't they? But in equal measure, they were very dependent on us, because it had started with a piece of design. It was a very, very small master plan. So again, not my bag. And it was a very, very small master plan. And it had to start with that initially. The architect still had to start with it. And then the cost consultant would cost it. And
could that design that you were doing change?
Because based on their input, and ultimately the cost consultant kept going, can't build it. Yeah. We actually did, and we were like, don't worry about it, you need. So it was a real, honestly, right? Yeah. It was a great idea, but I think it could have been just put together a bit better.
I remember for that one, so I designed it and I was obviously presenting. We'd done a presentation and someone changed the presentation and didn't tell me. So
you were presenting something.
There was a power struggle. About, that's kind of what I'm getting at as well. There was a power struggle.
Presenting in, it was like about 250 people, wasn't it?
It was a big lecture hall. Yeah.
Full. And they changed the order. So I had like slides written down to sort of prompt me what to say, and none of it matched.
So Jack's going, so the massing and the scale is the, and then what's on there is like a big cost plan or something. we're going, what?
Wow.
Yeah. But again, no, going back, Jack said about presenting, the architect out of everyone was expected to present, because we were a bit older as well, typically, because they were in third year. And obviously that doesn't always apply in uni, but you know what I mean? So typically we were a bit older, but the perception was, well, you're the architect, you're the one who presents all the time.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, so there was a lot on the architect. There was a lot riding on what the architect was doing and producing. And it didn't matter a great deal to us, because it was a very small part of our first year of masters.
I don't think the mark counted, did it?
Well, again, they told us it didn't, who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
But nonetheless, their degree was on the line, whereas ours, it was a very small portion. Very strange dynamic.
And I suppose, just the whole thought process behind doing that module where you're teaming up with those other consultants is, it's true to life. You come out got to work with quantities of age,
different personalities,
all these other consultants that come into a job, you have got to work with them, and it's probably your first taste properly of where you're in charge of that group. You know, you're leading the design team essentially, aren't you, in that module, and that's, you know, where you end up once you're out as a professional. So
well remembered.
So
because we properly skipped over that, didn't we? I got stuck, by the way,
got stuck in Madrid.
Little side one, yeah. I had to kind of get like sort of a bit of second hand from Jack, and then thankfully there was actually two from our course peer group.
Right.
So you did have someone else, you know, a friendly face, if you like. Yeah. And so my guy was just sending me bits, and I was just, you know, offering comments and stuff. But it was when there was a massive snowstorm in Europe, it was, and all airports around Europe were just
I thought it was it not the ash cloud? I thought it was
no,
the ash
no, it wasn't. No, it was snow. It was definitely snow.
It was January,
it was
freezing.
Wasn't it? Right. Yeah, it was January. And so literally the plane couldn't get out the airport and it certainly couldn't land back home as well. So I remember being like three, four days late as well, which was an even weirder dynamic for me because the architect was meant to sort, you know, meant to be in charge of it all.
Yeah.
And I was just rocking up.
No one knew who you were on the last day.
No one knew who it was. And they still went to me, oh, you seem pretty confident. Do you want to present it? I was like, no, I don't know about it. But what was bizarre was it was a triangular site. I went straight in and went, why isn't there a tower on that? Why, you know,
it's the Baltic. It's a site I'm working on now.
It's not.
It is.
Is it?
Yeah. I've just remembered.
It's the Baltic.
I don't know. Yeah. I can't say too much.
It's in the Baltic Triangle.
Yeah.
It's a site. I'm actually
right. So, isn't that weird then? Because we're arguing for a tall building. So yeah. Anyway, so I went, why isn't there a tall building on that? And everyone looked at each other and went, you're messing. It's like, we, you know, half and half. Like, they literally had a scrap over the height of the building. And I went, well, there's no doubt about it. That is a pinnacle of the Baltic Triangle. It needs a tall building. It needs a gateway. It needs a threshold.
That's mental. I'd have to remember that. That's a site we're actually doing.
Yeah. There you go. So preparing you for the real world, literally.
And everyone, let's have this right as well. Everyone. So everyone got given the same site. There was about 20 groups. Everyone put a tower on it. Everyone.
Yeah. So it was a good job you turned up in the end.
Yeah.
Don't know what they'd have done without you, lad.
That wasn't my point. You're both misunderstood me there.
No.
My point is that site we're now working on does need a tour.
No.
Because absolutely everyone did realise, didn't they, that if that's the focal point of the area, then it has to have a focal element, doesn't it? So.
Okay, so I realise we're probably getting a bit running out of time now for this one. So just to,
no, I think we've got enough time for the Q&A, though, haven't we?
No, but just to finalise, because we haven't talked about the marks that you got either at the end. So just to let everyone know, at the end of your journey, you've finished. You know, all your work's done. You're waiting for your mark. How did you get on? What was that like?
So they're called something very different now. I actually think they've gone back to a first 2-1-2-2, I think, for the Masters now. At the time we'd done it, it was distinction, merit, pass.
Right.
And that was first 2-1-2-2.
Okay.
That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the order of it. We both got a merit. And you know, I say this all the time, you just laugh at me, but we both got robbed in different ways. 70% was a distinction. And he got 69, didn't he?
You would remember 69, you dirty bastard. Yeah.
This is a clean part. This is a family show.
It's a family show.
Wash your mouth out.
So whether it was 69, 68, whatever.
It was 69.
Yeah. So there we go. So we got robbed in different ways because I was 61. So I was gutted. I was bottom end of it. He was top end of it. And I felt robbed in my way where I felt like I deserved more than that.
Yeah.
And I think with his one, 100% warranted top marks for
but
me.
Just to get into the politics of it, the reason why you're saying that is because there's probably only so many distinctions that can be handed out per year. Is the thought process, maybe not.
No,
maybe
no,
not,
no, 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 no.
Is the thought process.
They tell you there isn't, but there has
then
to be, doesn't
in
there?
In your group of four, the other two both distinctions. Got distinctions.
Yes.
So there's a thought process there. He couldn't give all four of his distinctions. So yeah.
Just to
clarify that. No, that'll make you two sleep better tonight. Yeah, anyway.
I sleep fine.
I am over it. You just reminded me now, but yeah, I am over it.
Yeah. You've kicked them off all afternoon.
No. But it comes from a place of the other two that got distinctions, just for the record, they wholly deserved it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let's have that right, because they were fantastic, and I know that both of them now are doing very well as well. Yeah. So, you know, good luck to them. They were brilliant. But I do feel that we were judged against an absolute gold level, gold standard. And dare to say, I think it, you know, potentially if we were more you, to be honest, I'm not trying to just throw you under the bus, because you were borderline on getting that distinction, you may well have got a different result, mightn't you, if you were somewhere
possibly,
else.
Yeah.
Possibly. That's what I'm saying. But again, won't name names. But when, more me, when I was running around kicking off, I thought I deserved a higher mark than what I got anyway. I don't think I deserved a distinction, to be fair, so I still got the merit. So it wouldn't have made much difference if I got 61 or 65 either way. But just in my little bit of, just having a little bit of a moan on the day, one of the tutors did just sort of say to me that your kind of attitude towards fifth year did have something to do with it.
Right.
So
everything counts.
So as we said, you know, at the start, it didn't have a direct impact, but it did have a bit more of an overarching sort of, because they do ultimately have to put you in a bit of a league table, don't they? They have to prioritise it. And let's just say, for argument's sake, they could only give five distinctions out. And say they're really struggling to pick that five. It's like goal difference almost, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
there might have been 10 and they've gone, well, they didn't quite perform well in the distinction. They didn't quite perform well in fifth year. They didn't quite do well in this module. And what happens is that probably is the decider then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe that's what happened. I don't know. But, you know, quite happy. And for everyone who's watching, I don't think it makes a blind bit of difference in the real world. The difference between, and this is my personal opinion, this does not reflect the opinions of academia. Yeah. But in my opinion, I think there isn't much of a difference between the top two. I think practices probably may have an opinion on any ranking below that.
Yeah.
Personally, I think the top two, number one, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
But I think the top two portray a certain level of competence, rightly or wrongly, by the way. I'm not necessarily saying that that's my opinion, but my opinion is that the industry probably doesn't see much between them two. And then, well, we know practices that ask for first only, don't we, and all that sort of stuff. So I would say I think to get a 2-1 or a merit or what have you, I think there's ways you can achieve that. Yeah. I think I got mine over the line. With in the end, I done some really good visuals.
Mm.
You know, I created one or two key spaces. Mine was the artificial end, and it was about robotic bees plugging the gap of the bee population depleting. And the idea is you could program the bee in a certain space. So you could go into a lab full of bees, but they wouldn't sting you because they're programmed to only operate in a certain space and all that sort of stuff. And it was an existing technology, so I done a bit of research on that. And I created this one amazing space where all that technology was just on display. You know, these glass pods were all hanging down and you could see, you know, the bees in action and stuff like that. And you could see natural bees that were, they were being, what's the word for it? Bred.
Yeah,
things like that. Yeah.
I think yours, I remember, it was the Center for Robotic Bees, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the robotic bees were learning off the natural bees.
That's it. So there was all artificial. There was a bit of a hybrid and all that sort of stuff. I reckon I just goes into the merit range with just nice, going back to software stuff, just nice visuals. I mean, I had one key space as well. The atrium space was about 30 floors tall. You know, it was dead impressive. But it was good visuals, good drawings, you know, well-rendered drawings, good line weights, all that sort of stuff. I think I just goes into that bracket with just a nice presentation. The end. Yeah. Whereas I look back, the narrative could have been better. The design could have been a lot better, to be honest.
No, good. So that explains obviously the master's journey as well. So one last one on it. What would be your top tip for success? So whether it's something that you actually did that you feel like got you somewhere, or whether you feel like it's something that if you could go back, you would do this time. Obviously, you've touched on always staying focused. Would that be yours, or is there anything else that you'd want to give as a tip to succeed?
I'd probably treat it like a job. We sort of got into this terrible habit of working through the night, didn't we? And then we'd be shattered of a daytime.
We
couldn't be bothered with lectures because we'd been up all night. I'd probably just treat it like a job.
That's why we were missing the lectures, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So just manage your time better.
Manage the structure of your time better.
But more 9 to 5, though, is your point, isn't it? You know, we say in our office, don't we, about, you know, we do our thinky stuff in the morning, don't we?
Yeah.
Whereas we never had the opportunity. So we felt like we were always tired, don't we?
Yeah.
We forged a relationship with the local kebab shop, didn't we? Do you know us? After a couple of months, because we were always in there at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Still working.
With everyone at the end of a night out, we were just starting our bloody project. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't even know how we got into that mode. We could have just...
We should have just evolved into it, didn't we? And then you get up an hour later, you go to bed an hour later, and then
and it gets the whole day worse.
Shifted, didn't it?
Whereas we never got any more productive. We didn't work any more hours. It was just, we just got into this weird habit of just working through the night. Whereas, that's a great shout. Just get a bit more structure and a bit more 9 to 5. And my one's the teamwork. I honestly can't see past. I mentioned about my experience of once I almost lost touch with the group. So once we went from a really strong group of four, I then got a little bit solo or siloed even, you know what I mean? I siloed myself.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, the top tip is if you're doing group work in that order, or even if some unis do the group work at the end, I would say really embrace that teamwork. So if I could go back and do it again, I would actually still try and lean on Jack's skills, the other two skills, all the way through the remainder rather than just keeping it to the...
Yeah.
I think I'd have done a lot better. And anyone else, you know what I mean? Just got a bit more involved with the year group.
Yeah. Okay. Good. And just worth noting as well that it is the be all and end all when you're in it. Like, you know, that mark at the end of it, when you're in the midst of that, it is the be all and end all.
There's nothing more important, is there?
Yeah, but it is worth noting that there's a long way to go after that. And no matter what mark you get, whether it's pass, merit, distinction, 2-2, 2-1, first, whatever it's called now, you're always learning. You're always improving. And the architect you are at the end of your masters is not the architect that you're destined to be.
Nowhere near.
You can always improve, and you will.
Even recover. So I said there about if you did get a lower mark at uni and you're finding that maybe you're being judged and all that sort of stuff, there's still a chance to maybe enter a competition or maybe even get another qualification, maybe just do a 12 months out on something else and get top marks in that. Or there's still an opportunity, isn't it, to just improve your skills and all that sort of stuff. But we've been swayed by people who've shown a different type of character. I always talk about hand delivering things, stuff like that. If you've got lower marks and you're finding that you can't separate yourself, well, there's a few tips where just start to show some of these other skills then that maybe other people haven't got.
Yeah. So spot on. So we've got time for one quick Q&A. Time for one quick Q&A. So we've had a member right here who's the owner of their own practice, and what they've asked is they've got a troublesome client in the way of they've being tasked with a brief to design them a new building, and they're a long way away with they've come a long way with that. So they've done a lot of
changes.
Design.
Yeah, they've done it's to do with don't be shy to crack the paper out. So the question is, and it's from a member, isn't it? It's from an existing member. Yeah. It's to do with design changes, even when they've hit the brief.
Yeah, so he's saying basically he feels the brief in the first few iterations of this, but the client's still coming back and asking for more and more changes. Yeah. It's now eating into his time. Something that we see a lot of practice owners. So the question is, what advice can you give? Should he be charging extras, or, you know, is this something that he just has to do as part of his initial fee?
Go on, Jack. Do you want to?
I suppose it's keeping an active dialogue with them throughout. So you can't just spring it on them. You know, 6 months down the line, you probably need to be communicating that it's verging on beyond the scope of the service at this point, and a discussion needs to be had on either he needs to sign it off, or it was signed off and therefore it's subject to an extra fee, or I don't know. It's a tricky one, isn't it?
So go back to the start, right? But this is from experience, isn't it? In our documentation now, we send it out, we dictate three revisions. So we say, for this fee, you get three design revisions. And if you don't achieve those three design revisions in that time period, we almost put the onus on the client by saying, well, provided that we do, you know, we fit the brief, you've then got three revisions of that. So number one is, here's the design that meets your brief. You've then got three opportunities to provide comments, changes, and that's the client changes. If it's a planning change or something like that, we normally absorb that, don't we? Because that's not the client's doing, if you like. It's not the client's fault. So if it's a planning change, a building reg change, something like that, we absorb that. It's three client revisions. So it's easy when you've got that, because at the start you say three revisions. And then what you do is you need to be clear in saying that that's round one.
Yeah.
So once you do your initial one, that's your initial thingy, and you explain how you've hit the brief.
Yeah.
They then come back with changes, and then you say, okay, here's revision one. And then you can do that in your title blocks, can't you, of your drawings. Here's revision one, here's revision two, here's revision three. On the third revision, you should announce that and say, this is the third and final revision. However, I think the question is grounding a little bit. What if they haven't got that initially? What if they haven't got the documentation? You know, look, when we started off, it was all spit and a handshake, wasn't it? You know what I mean? We were very naive at first. We thought, oh, we'll just get it in writing on an email and happy days.
Yeah.
No, you know, everyone's dead nice. And sadly, often, not even just sometimes, often, yeah. it turns the other way. And you've got to really cover yourself, haven't you?
It's key to delineate the number of revisions in your fee proposal, and it's key to get a fee proposal out and signed by the client.
Sign is the key thing.
You need something in documentation. Even sometimes we have accepted it on email with the fee proposal attached, where they've come back and said, read this, and it's acceptable.
Yeah.
You need something in writing from their email address or handwritten that says, we accept the fee and we accept that it's this many revisions.
Yeah.
Because if you haven't got that, and I'm with you on this, it sounds like they haven't got that documentation, yeah. then you are in a bit of a pickle, because you know the client's going to argue that you owe them something, and you're in a bit of an impasse then, because you're going to have to either agree something or you're going to have to agree to walk away.
So I've got an idea. If the question is grounding, because it didn't explicitly say it, but if the question a little bit between the lines is, I haven't quite got the documentation. Well, there's nothing stopping you drawing the line now and saying from this point you've got X amount of revisions, is there?
Yeah.
There's nothing stopping that. So as long as you can at this point in time say, here's the brief, right? So you'll have received the brief either on an email or something like that. Or again, if you haven't, you can still define the brief yourself. So you can say, the brief is this, and here's a pack of drawings that meets the brief. Let's just start again.
Yeah.
Here's where we're up to. From this point, my advice would be to not go too aggressive, as Jack said there. It's bad form to just come out of nowhere with an extra or come out of nowhere with you've run out of revisions when you haven't been clear with that from the start. So I would say there's nothing stopping you drawing that line now and retrospectively creating just a one piece of A4 to say, from this point, dated, you have now got three revisions from the point of this, and get them to write a brief. If there's no brief at this point, get them to write a brief. You can bring someone in line.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10, I've worked with clients where no matter how much you kick and scream about, you know, this is done now, it's froze, the design's frozen, there are your 1 in 10 there, they will just keep on at you and on at you and on at you. And to get out of that, I think there's a little harsh truth of, there's just got to be a point where you've just got to decide, have you concluded your service? And the service can still be retrospectively done as long as you've given the client plenty of notice and you're saying, from this point on, this is the term of service. Yeah. I'm going to give you three revisions from this point, even though we've done 10.
Yeah.
You're going to get three more is term of service. If at that point, the continuing, I think because you've created that line, you've created that documentation, there is actually a point at which you can walk away.
Yeah, you can draw your line in the sand.
There is such a thing.
I sent you this email or this document that has advised you. We are now at that point. So it's either an extra fee, which I can submit, or a walk away.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You've got that stuff. You know, it's ready for handover.
Yeah.
And away you go.
I think the REBA terms as well, retrospectively, if you're struggling, probably cover that, don't they?
I think so, yeah.
Is it whatever iteration of the agreement up to now?
Well, a little plug.
Kenny deals with that, so I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. The little plug for the RIBA is, we're a chartered practice and we use their documentation to inform our own terms and conditions, schedule of service, appointments of an architect.
Yeah.
We use all that on a regular basis. So as Jack said there, I would encourage this member, but obviously the point of doing this on a podcast is to give that advice to everyone, is to really get immersed in that documentation because it's very important. But another one is, just on this topic, is the idea of losing money on a project. It took me a few years. I think it clicked for you a little bit earlier than me. A 10 grand fee sounds amazing, especially when you're a one-person band where you're like, yeah, 10 grand, happy days. How can I possibly lose money on that? And it's a real harsh lesson that we've learned, isn't it? And it sounds obvious now, but it isn't at the time. You just see the 10 grand, don't you?
Yeah.
And it's if you pay yourself 3 grand a month and you work on that for 4 months, solid, well, you've spent 12 and you're only earning 10.
Yeah.
And there are clients out there that will pay twice that and be half as a nuisance.
Yeah.
So I think what we found is the more clear and deliberate you are with clients and the more you grow that ability to walk away,
yeah.
I think you do attract, whether it's kind of like a literal thing where maybe it, you know, it just, the word gets out, or maybe it's a bit more philosophical, a little bit more energy out there in the universe. I think you do start to attract the right sort of people when you grow that ability to walk away as well.
I think, like, even for us, you know, when you're referring to examples of us, our communications got better. And I mean that in every sense of the word. So communication person to person, communication on email, and communication in documentation.
Yeah.
That's gotten better over time. With every time we feel like we might have lost money somewhere or done something wrong, we've looked at the terms and gone, well, actually, we weren't quite protected there. Yeah. Slide that one in, make sure that doesn't catch us again. And then, as you say, over time, with that better communication and understanding your deliverables better, making sure your client understands your key deliverables better, that means that you are basically attracting the right clients, because the ones that'll sign up to it. If someone looks at your terms or your deliverables and goes, hang on, no, I don't agree with that, then it's always a bit of a red flag, isn't it, now, where we go, well, look, there's a reason.
It's a great test. Well, we now have deposits and all that sort of stuff too, and it's a genuine thing, a deposit. Resources that our first 4 weeks of working the job up, getting it set up, all the investigation you need to undertake, all the research, all that sort of stuff. And by the way, you know, obviously this is a genuine query. We've not set it up in this way, but this week's tip of the week is on a fee and documentation. Oh, funny enough,
little plug there.
So So obviously every week, we've obviously got the courses on there, but every week, one of us or our guest tutors, they do contribute an additional lesson every week. And this week's one is how we use our fee scale, how we then apply that to a fee letter, how we split it with planning and delivery, and then how we use, and I think the biggest change in what we've done is the schedule of service. We've just done it, haven't we, on a big project where we've made clear to the client, using a strike-through system, that we don't do that, but don't delete it, leave it in there as a strike through to explicitly say that is a service we can offer, but under this term of service we don't.
Yeah.
That you just can't get clearer than that, can you? So that's all available now on a download and tip of the week.
There you go.
Spot on.
Right, well, I think that'll bring us to an end for today.
Yeah, another cracker.
Yeah, another good pod. Thanks as always for watching. Thanks to Adam and Jack as always. Check out our YouTube and please subscribe, and check out the socials, which will all be tagged below. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.